thanks for tuning in to the Mystery Stone Podcast. This is your host, CJ, here with...
Back again with Metaphysical Mike. How you guys doing?
Hey, we changed the title this time.
Yeah, every day it's something new, right?
We get you a different certificate every time.
I know, right? The Great Mike, Metaphysical Mike, yeah, just whatever, Mike.
Yeah. last week we covered esoteric and occult orders.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that along with the happiness episode, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was bonus content.
Yeah, okay.
So we did the bonus content. If you guys haven't tuned into the Bird Brain podcast, go ahead and check that out as well. He kind of expounded upon some of his points there in his most recent episode. But today we're kind of moving forward. We're getting into more practical zones, more things, less history, less knowledge, like less book knowledge, more practical knowledge today. Mike, do you want to tell them what we're covering?
Yeah, sure. Today we're going to be speaking primarily about magical symbols, tools, and their inherent purposes. So, you know, across magical systems, there's a plethora of tools that are used, a lot of symbols, a lot of scents, just a lot of things that kind of assault the senses and bring one's will or whatever they want to manifest during their ceremony or whatever practice they have and allow that idea to come to fruition. So,
just a little content warning ahead of time. I will be associating things with some very large religions and comparing and contrasting. Please don't take offense to that. This is purely educational. It's not meant to offend anybody, but be prepared. If you are a devout Christian, I'm about to compare some magical practices to things that go on inside your churches.
Yeah, there's a lot of rituals going on, you know, just across all religions, and there's a lot of stereotypes involved in like the occult or like magic. You know, it's just a whole like ritual aspect, and you know how a lot of these things kind of seem weird or out of the ordinary or eccentric. But you know, you can see like a lot of religious institutions or temples, you know, all their own different variations of interesting and I'd say uncommon practices that if you're not really engulfed in that religion or spiritual practice, you wouldn't necessarily expect upon walking in there. But yeah, I mean, there's rituals that happen across all different religions, sects, temples, you know, traditions, whether magical or, you know, traditional religion. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of similarities that go on here that we'll see.
Yeah. And I'm not singling out Christianity. When I make these comparisons, it's just going to be because that's where...
It's just a common religion, right?
No, I mean, it's just where my personal experience comes from, like where I can relate the things that I read in books to things that I've experienced in real life.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I also have a lot of experience with Christianity as we've explored in a previous episode too. So I'll be able to relate to that as well when it comes along. But, in terms of like the purpose, as like a general overview of a lot of the purposes of the tools or the symbols and a lot of the stuff we'll be talking about, you know, they are essentially just kind of like in any profession, whether you're like a scientist or, you know, you're an actor using stage props to, you know, express a certain concept, or, you know, or you're a scientist using a telescope as a tool of a means to getting an end. You know, it's there's a lot of tools that a magician would use or an occultist would use or someone in like a more hands-on, practical, I guess, spiritual approach that are used to attain a certain end.
I guess when it comes to things like ritual, it goes beyond the practice of magic in itself, and it does definitely expand into modern religion and very largely practiced religions, even the Abrahamic religions. Not a tool that I'm going to be talking about specifically, but like you could talk about like the chalice, which is very common in magical ritual practice, and we also see that during the process of communion within a Christian church, which in by definition is a ritual.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have the chalice containing the blood of Christ, or what's symbolic of blood of Christ, and then you have the plate, which is where the body comes from, and it's done. There's a specific system and there's a process. So it's very much so a ritual, not necessarily magic, but in itself is still a ritual. So those are the kind of comparisons that I'm personally going to be making.
Yeah, and even in, I guess to elaborate on that real quick, even in the eyes of a priest, you know, or in the Catholic Church at least, because not every church follows along with the same guidelines, but we're going to use Catholicism with this right now because it's the most widespread, I'd say. but it's one I've experienced with. But, you know, during the Catholic Mass even, they have, like, the Eucharist, which is, you know, symbolizes the body of Christ. And like CJ said, they have the chalice, which symbolizes the blood of Christ. And they also have, you know, various different symbols lining the churches or monuments or statues that are symbolic of things that are represented in the Bible. And they all carry with them or convey different meanings, different, you know, just different. They connect with to a lot of creative faculties in the mind that allow you to connect with those divine ideas or those divine concepts or just the divinities in general. Like you see, you know, there's a lot of symbols they use. And this is all comprehensive of what we're going to be speaking about today, because these are really widespread things. You can even see it with companies, but we'll get into that a little bit later when it comes to sigils. But yeah, and the ritual in the Catholic Church is essentially is they believe that they're transforming through the ritual of the Mass, which is very systematic. It's and ritualistic if you actually watch it. I think a lot of people are just so used to seeing it when they go to churches, they don't really question it or see the relation to other types of, I guess, personal or independent ritualistic practices. But they do believe that they are transforming the water in the chalice and the Eucharist into the literal body and blood of Christ. So through that process and through the words that they're using and the invocations that they're using and the calls to God and everything that to transform these things, they believe that an actual transformation happens. So that, in a sense, is using their imagination and their will, and is literally a magical ceremony at its core. And actually, probably one based on theurgy, if we had to be specific.
Okay, so I mean, we've covered the groundwork here real quick, but so what is the first tool that we're going to be discussing?
Well, as a whole, I just want to make the general statements quick that the tools essentially we're going to be speaking about are extensions of the magician's will. Or I'm just going to say magician because we are speaking about like a lot of metaphysical topics and practices and magic and stuff like that. But just the tools that are involved, they're kind of extensions of the will. They're things that are, if you want to get the best use out of them, it would be best if the actual magician crafts them themselves, because not only does crafting these tools or assembling these tools or seeking them out to use them strengthen the will, it shows the will to actually execute the rituals and stuff. Like it makes your will stronger by formulating these things, and
it's almost like a bond you're forming with the object.
Yeah, it's kind of like an external expression of an internal will. And if you just kind of buy a lot of these things already pre-made from somebody else, like their energies were put into it, you know, like they've already used their will to create it for monetary gains or, you know, passion or whatever they're doing, and you're just inheriting it, you know, without putting a lot of energy into yourself, not personalizing it yourself, like not having that personal connection to it, like you had said. So if anything, it's best to craft these on your own, or at least seek them out on your own, at the very least, you know. Today we're going to speak, in, I guess, first we'll speak about sigils, because these are probably one of the most commonplace things that we can see across the world, whether it be in a company or in a magic practice or whatever. Just like we had spoken about in the past, how like symbols are extremely important to the subconscious mind, and the subconscious mind is made up of symbologies and archetypes. In magic, you'll see a lot of sigils. Like, I'm sure a lot of you guys have seen these things. They're very interesting looking, either squiggles or geometric shapes, or they're kind of odd looking to someone who's not used to them, and even someone who is used to them, they're out of the ordinary. But usually, they're encapsulated within a circle. Sometimes they'll have like the name of the spirit or whatever the sigil is symbolizing around the symbol, or really around the circle. And depending on which grimoire or wherever they're coming from, you know, they all vary. And every spirit and a lot of forces and planetary beings, a lot of these, they all have their own specific sigil. And so it's just a visual expression of that inherent spirit or force. There's sigils that are attributed to spirits, like I had said, and then there's sigils you can actually create yourself. And I believe one of the most common methods to making a sigil yourself is you'll take like a mantra, something that you want to do to create a change within your psychology, And you'll write out like a I think we spoke about this in a previous episode, but I'm going to touch on it again because it's extremely relative. You'll write out like a mantra of something that you want to change within yourself, or say you're lacking confidence. You'll just like write down like, I am confident, or I am confident because of whatever. And you write that out, and then you cancel out all the vowels. You'll slash out all the vowels, so have left just the primary letters or whatever. And then you'll slash out all the letters that double themselves. And whatever letters you have left, then you'll construct those letters and connect them into like a symbolic little form underneath. And through connecting these letters with each other, you eventually turn it into like this composite symbol that encapsulates all the letters that were just in the original mantra. You know, of course, after the vowels and the excess letters were slashed out. And then you have this symbol, and you've created this symbol based off a sentence that you want to pretty much embed into your subconscious. And so you pretty much like meditate on that symbol, and you meditate on it so that your conscious mind opens way to your subconscious mind more easily in a trance. And you keep staring at it, and you meditate on it, and slowly, you know, at least the end goal with that type of sigil work is it creates a change within your subconscious, and you start to actually feel that within your personality. It becomes like a part of you. Either that, there's also other sigil magic where you create the sigil and you burn it with your intent, and it goes out into the universe, and that's just another form of a sigil. But yeah, that's
the key to the sigil is you have to allow it to be released. You don't want to hold on to it. So when you're doing like the meditation on it and the visualizing, if it begins to fade, you need to allow that to happen. If you try to grasp it and hold on to it, the energies will kind of, it won't do what it's supposed to, is the best way I can put that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very important to be focused on it too, and to actually believe in what you're doing. If you don't have any type of faith in what you're doing, then it's most likely not going to work. Or if you don't use your imaginative faculties or create like a passionate, not passionate, but like a passive trance, like atmosphere for your mind, like through meditation while gazing at the sigil, it won't have such a penetrative effect on your subconscious. And, any type of magical grimoire or you know, you'll find these sigils littered all over the place. They're pretty commonplace. And if by chance, like the listener isn't really privy to what we're talking about in terms of like a sigil, you can just type in the Google and you can see exactly what they look like. They're pretty interesting looking symbols. But in terms of one of the most important and common symbols that we find in magic is the pentagram. And the pentagram is just a regular five-pointed star. You can find it upright, or you can find it downright. But typically, it's found upright unless you're following like a Luciferian or a left-handed path, and you'll find it upside down. And the pentagram, that star, is also found in one of the most important rituals in magic in general, and that's the LBRP, or Lesser Banishing Ritual, the pentagram. And that's where, well, one part of the ritual is where you trace in the air and all the, in the four cardinal points, north, south, east, west. You draw them out, and you'll vibrate divine names of power into them. And in your imagination and in using your will, you'll visualize them pretty much like in front of you or surrounding you, protecting you and banishing around you the negative energies and igniting in blue flames or whatever your practice calls for. But yeah, the pentagram is an extremely important, highly and widely used symbol, and every point of the pentagram represents an element. The point at the top represents spirit, the element of spirit, or the akasha or akasa, depending on what tradition you're following. The top left point stands for air. The bottom left point stands for earth. The top right point stands for water. And the bottom right stands for fire. And we'll talk about the elements probably in another episode or another time. That's a whole other thing. It's like it deals with the constitution of everything in existence and how the ancients viewed it. And they all go together with, these four terms, fire, air, earth, water. And also a distinction to be made too, we commonly hear this term pentagram, and we also see pentagrams with circles around them, which is another common symbol that we see. And when we see a pentagram with a circle surrounding it, technically they're called a pentacle. So that's just a nice little brief thing to throw in there. Pentagram is a regular star. Pentacle is a star with a circle around it.
Yeah, the pentacle is commonly used in another tool we'll talk about later on the episode called amulet. That would technically be a talisman, and it wards off evil, where the pentagram itself would be used in craft and rites and rituals, whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm. You can also find the pentacles a lot in rituals and stuff. It's another primary, depending on what practice you're using. Ceremonial magic, it's pretty prominent. But yeah, then you also have other miscellaneous tools that, you know, you find in magic or even just any type of meditation work. A really common one could be a crystal ball and a black mirror. You'll find crystal balls and commonplace altars, black mirrors, depending on what you're trying to achieve. The black mirrors that people use are commonly made of obsidian. Obsidian's known for, you know, its purifying energy and its ability to dissuade and get rid of negativity. So it's kind of a safe scrying material to use, and also plays on the psychology with those attributes, you know.
Yeah, from what I read, the black mirror itself actually originated on something you could actually consider left hand path, where it was with the Aztecs, and people who would use the black mirror, they often associated them with black magic, would be primary candidates for human sacrifice if they found out they were doing that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I never heard about a black magic origin for that. It's interesting. Yeah, even like there's like you could scry with anything or use a lot of tools that are resemblant of a black mirror or crystal ball.
The bowl.
Yeah.
Bowl of water. Yeah.
Yeah, bowl of water, a cup of water.
What's that called? Hydromancy, I think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Hydromancy.
Yeah, yeah. If anything, I think it's called hydromancy. Yeah, hydromancy. I think even Joseph in the Bible, Jesus's father, whatever you want to call him, not literal father in the Bible, but Mary's husband. He was a scryer. I think he scryed using a bowl as well. So that's prominent in the Bible. And we're just touching upon like basic, you know, tools first. You know, crystal ball has the same thing. You gaze into it. You can call for a spirit to manifest inside of it, so you can see it. You know, the black mirror is the same thing. Not a lot of traditions use black mirrors commonly. I like to use black mirrors personally for contemplative work or meditative work, any type of psychological work, or if I'm trying to like extract any information about a certain concept or idea. It's like a focal point. You can gaze into your mind, and it's just I don't know, for me, it's one of my most favorite tools to use for gleaning insights into whatever it is I'm trying to learn more about. And then, you know, and also with all these tools, symbols, and everything like that, like, you know, the stereotypical magician is someone who has, you know, like has like a robe on, who's surrounded by all types of weird little instruments and tools. But, you know, when you think about it, like all these tools, the scents, the colors, all this stuff, they all play into the psychology. And they all have attributes that all harmonize with each other. And when you have all these things surrounding you and you're focusing your will and intent and using your imagination to create an end, and you're really putting energy into that stuff, all these things harmonize with each other to aid your cause. Say like, as we'll see, like different tools correlate with different elements and stuff like that. And like, colors will attribute the different scents, different scents will attribute the different spirits, different numbers will attribute the different colors, and they all come together to formulate a focal point and to stimulate the mind into achieving a certain end.
Yeah, it really lets us transition to the main thing that really ties a lot of that together, and be like the spoken word.
Yeah.
Or the internal word, even. Some people won't speak out loud, but especially in Judaism, the spoken word is a very strong tool, and they are also very, very careful about how it's spoken, and their written language. Their written word was supposed to have divine origins as well as the language of Hebrew. The alphabet in itself possesses creative powers. Just for an example, when they talk about God creating the universe, it's implied that he's speaking Hebrew when he does that, and he does that with his word.
Yeah, in the beginning was the word, and the word was God.
And even when it comes to stage magicians, a lot of people are familiar with stage magicians, you know, and the famous term abracadabra, which come, well, they theorize that it comes from Aramaic, avracadavra, which means...
I create as I speak.
I create as I speak, right. So, I mean, you would take that spoken word and, like, all these tools that we mentioned so far, and you always need more than one tool for a job. You can't just do one thing and not utilize. So all of this stuff just really comes together.
And it's interesting, too, because all these tools aren't even necessary to use to do magic. If one's an adept, you know, an adept is somebody who's really mastered their mind and has trained their mind in all the elements and have broken themselves down psychologically and rebuilt themselves to be in full control of their own energies and energies around them. Someone who's like who really understands the nature of magic in the metaphysical realm and how to interact themselves with you know, just someone who's really in control of themselves and in their destiny at that point. Adepts don't necessarily need to use any type of tools. I mean, tools in themselves are just that. They're tools. I mean, to achieve an end.
Yeah, the adept is almost by definition just, it's an internal, completely internal process, where a magician is an external process.
Yeah, like an adept is someone who has like all the elements within him and his mind completely in harmony with each other and has trained his will and imagination to the point where he's an adept by definition. You know, he's someone who's a master of himself and the elements within and without. And so, like, when you're at that level, you know, tools aren't necessary, although they're always there as an aid. They always aid the mind. And so, you know, they're continuing to be used. When it comes to vibration of the words or, like, the spoken word, there's a lot of words that people use in ritual, like a lot of divine names or words of power or names of God or names of spirits or names of planetary spirits or whatever it might be. It's very common in ceremonial magic or ceremonial rites that these names will be vibrated. Like, say, like, in the lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram, which you brought up earlier, with each pentagram, you thrust into it a divine name. The star, the pentagram in the east, you vibrate into it, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which essentially would sound like, Yod Heh Vav Heh, or something like that. And you pretty much do that around which every star around you. And in certain rites, depending on what spirit you're conjuring up, you'll do it in the same way. And in intonation and the rate of vibration and how you hold it, and conjunction with the imagination and your mind and your focal point, and everything, it just is using all your senses, and it's using the internal vibration to bring you into focus. Like I had said earlier, it all goes into the art form of magic and achieving the end, or achieving some type of subconscious change, or trying to invoke something or evoke something. So yeah, vibration is extremely important and prominent in magical practices, and it just deals with the law of vibration and the psychological effect. And you also see colors being used in magic too a lot. A lot of colors, like, say, you know, everyone has a certain favorite color, and when you ask them about it, you know, if they really start to think about it, there's something about that color that resonates with their personality. Someone likes red. Maybe my favorite color is personally red. But for me, red just symbolizes passion. I'm just a very passionate person. Things I'm passionate about, I'll go all in about. I go all in. And red to me, it just, I don't know, it just resonates with something within me. So red can mean like a, like I said, like passion. Blue for somebody who likes blue. Maybe they're more of a relaxed type of person. Maybe they're more of an intuitive type of person. You know, like whatever color someone likes the most, usually it's tapping into something within their personality, something that resonates with them. And in magic, you know, colors are attributed to different scents, like I said, different oils, different spirits. And it plays on the psychological mind because it helps to evoke or invoke within somebody a certain feeling. As do scents, as do oils, as do perfumes. And when you have like certain perfumes that are attributed to certain spirits, ablaze or set in a room or being burned, and you're smelling that, when you're smelling that scent and you're seeing those colors and you're positioning yourself in certain directions and you're fully focused on what you're doing, or you're in a trance, or you have these tools, or you have like a black mirror, a crystal ball, and you're in that setting, you're in that drama, you're in that ceremony, it really helps to hone your mind in It really helps to allow you to tap in to things that you wouldn't really be able to do in ordinary consciousness without all these things surrounding your senses and having that assault on your mind to, you know, bring that ceremony to fruition.
Yeah, mentioning colors, that also ties in very well with another tool, which is wands.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of magicians will use daggers and wands. Wands specifically, there is the quest for having all elements channeled through a single wand, which is, depending on the path you're on, somewhat impossible, being that things like water will cancel out fire. But when it comes to the colors, they have something called a rainbow wand. Hmm. Now, the rainbow wand is primarily constructed using the astrology with colors that are associated the symbolism for the planets, things such as that. It's an astrological thing, and they used it to practice what you would call gray magic. And that's how they get around having all the elements in one place without them countering each other, is through the construction of the rainbow wand. There's actually a pretty decent set of instructions on how to create one within the book Modern Magic.
Donald Michael Craig, excellent book. If you're a beginner, check it out.
And no, we're not paid for this.
We're not paid for this.
That would be nice, but we're not.
Yeah.
No, in all seriousness, though, the rainbow wand in itself is something that I found very interesting when I was going through and checking out all these different tools and whatnot.
Yeah, and sorry for all the listeners who might be hard to follow this along. You know, this is a really technical episode, and it's going to be encompassing a lot of different tools, and that these tools go into different rites, different ceremonies, and even these tools that we're talking about can be found in different variations, or they might be named something different in different traditions. So we're really trying to come together here and trying to create some type of like a structure here, you know, and explain a lot of these things the best as we can, because we're also coming from two different sides of the coin too, you know, or... So sorry if there's any type of confusion, but we're trying to create some type of structure. But when it comes to the wand and ceremonial magic, there's four primary tools that you often see on altars, and that is the wand, the sword, the cup, and the pentacle. And these four different things are extremely common, whether it be Wicca as well, or a lot of traditions, they have these four different tools. They're just commonplace tools. There's other tools as well that are used, but they're always usually found on the altar inside of the circle in which the magician stands. And we'll speak about the circle in a little bit.
Yeah, when we reach, like, protection.
yeah, protection for sure. The sword or dagger or athame, you know, depending on what tradition you're following, they're all pretty much the same thing. So the sword, dagger, athame represents the element of fire. And these four elemental tools I just spoke about, they all represent an element, one of the four elements we had spoken about earlier. And the sword is primarily used for banishing. Then you have a cup that you typically find in the ceremonial magician's altar. And the cup can be filled with water. It can be filled with a libation, a sacrificial substance, an alcoholic drink, you know, some type of sacrifice, for a spirit at times. Other times it's just used for a symbol. It can symbolize intuition, understanding, you know, things of that sort. Like I said, they're all things to aid the mind. Then you have the wand, which symbolizes the element of air. It invokes authority and wisdom and symbolizes, you know, pretty much a magician's creative internal will. And then you have the pentacle, which represents the element of earth, which kind of is like a composite element that has all the elements within it. And its final stage... and that can symbolize the body, mind, and will. So you can, yeah, like I said, you can find these commonly just sitting on top of the magician's altar within the circle. And the circle itself is another tool. It, like she just said, it's a tool for protection. It's found across various different traditions, and it can either be like drawn on the ground. You can draw it on some type of onto some type of like. Sheet or some type of parchment or some type of fabric. It might take a long time to construct if you really care about your craft.
Yeah, the circle, there's so much variation.
So many.
It can be casted.
Mm-hmm.
I did see throughout all practices, the circle is utilized. It's utilized in left-hand path. It's utilized in right-hand path.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody is doing demonic work, they'll utilize a circle to keep them safe from the demon they're trying to talk to.
Yeah, they might want to have like 15 circles around them at that point, dude. But
yeah, that's a nah, just kidding, but. That's a. I mean, you're kidding, but not really. Like,
just be protected as the.
You got to really if that's something that you're going to do, you really need to be very cautious within yourself and make sure that your protections are there, because even in right hand paths, you don't always get the spirit you're after.
No, you don't.
To try to communicate with, so protection is extremely important.
Yeah, and even say, like, there's always been a debate in magic whether the spirits are real or part of your psyche. A lot of people say they're a mixture of both. I kind of feel like they're a mixture of both as well. I've had some experiences personally where they definitely seemed external. I've had some experiences where they seem conjoined, and I had some experiences where they seem psychological. But yeah, that's another interesting concept. But in terms of the circle, it's typically found, well, sometimes people like to trace it with their athame or their dagger or their sword during their rites in the beginning, and they'll trace it around them using their imagination, and it's like a fortification for the magician to, at least in their mind, symbolize protection from demonic ideas or demonic forces or entities, or just as a symbol to keep their own thoughts out of the operation that might be negative. Just anything to aid the mind in its cause or its focus or its intent. Oftentimes, the circle will have geometrical figures, pentagrams inscribed in the inside of it, different insignia, symbols, sigils, things of the like, depending on the work that they're doing. And it's also commonplace for around the circle to have divine names written around it, whether it be like Tetragrammaton or Elohim or, you know, El or all, whatever Hebrew god names, or a billion other different type of god names, Mikael, angel, archangel names, Gabriel, Raphael, Uriel, you know, just so many different names you might find surrounding it, which also aids in the protection aspect of the circle and aids the mind in understanding its divinity. And the circle essentially also stands for the magician as like a sphere of consciousness, like his own little universe, and he's the master of it, and he's in control when he's in that circle, and he pretty much stands for a divine figure who has authority and grants commands on top of it all. So it's just an extremely important symbol that's used because of multiple aspects, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just wrong. We are on the topic of protection. We could probably talk about amulets and talismans at this point, where an amulet or a talisman would be an object that you could wear on your person. It could be near you. Well, very different ways that you can utilize that. There is a significant difference between an amulet and a talisman. Talismans are made by man. You can take an amulet and turn it into a talisman by inscribing things upon it. But these just examples of talismans would be the crucifix in itself, the pentacle if you're wearing one, even crystals that you would hang off a chain. Well, no, technically, I guess a crystal would technically be an amulet unless you did something to it. Amulets are occurring in nature, and you take them and you utilize them without changing them, and that's what makes that into an amulet. Also, talismans are utilized to draw things to you, and amulets are designed to repel things away from you. So you would utilize a talisman to, say, bring those positive energies towards you and towards your circle, and an amulet would help repel negative spirits and negative energies, things that you don't want going on within your circle.
Well, that also mean that an amulet uses, like, the inherent energy of whatever person's using it for, and like a talisman, the magician would put their own energy and intent into whatever object that they are using as a talisman.
Right.
I'm assuming. Yeah.
Right.
Because I know talismans, like, to craft them, you put your own energy and intent into them and infuse it with whatever your will, you know, is to be, and it supposedly attracts to you that which you're seeking out because of that infusion of energy.
Right, there's a whole pile of different ones too. Like, there's a Hindu one, for example, where you would take the splinters of 10 holy trees, and that talisman would protect you from demonic possession. Talismans and amulets are used in a lot of different craft. You see them a lot in Egyptian, Byzantine, Finnish, Greek, Jewish, Mesopotamian, North American, and back to the Romans. You can also see like various talismans and amulets done like with like the sign of Venus, the goddess Venus, that promotes like fertility. When you're crafting an amulet or empowering an amulet or crafting a talisman in itself, the amulets are done under the waning moon, and your talismans would be done under a waxing moon for most potent effect, depending on the path you're on.
Yeah. Like we were saying, like before, like different traditions utilize all these things we're talking about in different ways. Just a lot of things we're talking about. This is like a common approach, at least in ceremonial magic, it's just a commonly known approach. But so if a lot of these things seem off in different people's traditions or to name something different, that's a reason for it. Talismans and amulets could also be used in ritual aspects as well. Say like you have a ceremonial ritual going on, where you're trying to, you know, harness the energies of Mars or the spirits, or trying to contact the spirits of Mars, for whatever purpose you're utilizing that energy for. You might have a talisman charged with or infused with Mars energy, and you might bring that to the ritual, which aids in the resonance or the intent of the operation as well. So that goes into it. And you can also have like gems, stones, crystals as talismans too, or you infuse into them energies, or you can even infuse into them certain types of spirits and stuff like that. But crystals, stones, and gems all have their own inherent occult properties or virtues that are used in rituals as well that aid the magician, just like any other tool that he uses. Just anything that helps.
Yeah, and a lot of these are still utilized within major religions today. Like I said, for example, just from my own experience within Christianity, you'll see your priest or your pastor with a very large crucifix or a cross strung around their neck. I know that priests will occasionally have rings that we call them parishioners. Is that?
Yeah, I'm not really sure about that one.
You would kiss that. I guess technically speaking, that could technically be a talisman. It's worn on the body and has intent with it.
Yeah.
There are other holy talismans that will contain the remains of saints. They'll have like the toe bone of a saint within this talisman, and it would have specific properties and be very incredibly crafted out of gold, not necessarily bodily remains. They do contain bones and stuff quite a bit, but they could also have pieces of possessions that that saint had, like a piece of fabric from like their clothing that they commonly wore, things like that.
Yeah, the idea behind that, I'm assuming, is like it carries their energy, or it was a part of them, or it's like an extension of them, or has some type of correlation with them in which it'll be, you know, used or at least aid somebody, or have some type, just any type of connection to its original owner, I would assume.
Yeah, and I mean, and Christians, and rightfully so, do believe that these objects contain power, and they do. They will definitely help you. Like, if you need to ward evil away, a crucifix is fantastic for that.
Yeah, it's all the same thing. It's all the same type of concept. Whether one's right or wrong is a whole other story. I think it all comes down to what your intention is, or what harm you're causing, you know? But yeah, we see rituals across rituals, talismans, so like, whether you want to call it a symbol, a cross, or like just any type of article that one wears that aids somebody on their path or something in life or financial success, or even something, you know, like when you're a kid and you have like these little like those little rabbit foot keychains that are supposed to bring you good luck. I mean, that aids your mind thinking it's going to give you good luck, so you feel luckier, you feel like you have better fortune. You know, you literally feel it in your mind and your body. Like it creates some type of form of feeling, and that's just something as small as that, let alone putting together all these things we're talking about today in one location, all together, harmonized at the same point in time. You're utilizing all these things at one time, and you're experiencing all this stuff while in a trance-like state, you know, vibrating the names and having the sigils and the circle around you and a crystal ball or a black mirror, whatever operation you're doing. It's just, it can be a really transcendental experience if you're actually the one doing it, especially when you're the only one doing it, alone doing it. And oftentimes, like, all these rituals happen in the dark with, like, candles and so fumigations or smoke. And which, getting to it, smoke is also another tool used in magic and ceremonial work. Like, people use the burning of incense. And in the dense particles of smoke, that could be a vehicle for the manifestation of a spirit. Just whatever a force can use to manifest is a tool used. We also have the lamp. A lamp is used in ceremonial work, and that's usually held above the magician's head. And it's typically fueled, I believe, with olive oil. And, you know, olive oil is one of the more healthier, pure oils that we have. And that oil constantly burning above the magician's head while he's in the circle symbolizes for him his higher self or his divine self, the self that the theurgist is constantly trying to attain and commune with. So that aids his mind in an elevated state of mind while doing his divine work. We also have the robe that the magician will wear. And the robe can symbolize, it symbolizes like the concealment of his inner glory, you know, his just the in various different traditions you'll find a lot of spiritual people in robes, whether it be a magician or, you know, Buddhist or, you know, all types of people, and they all symbolize different things.
It's also a practical application, mm-hmm. where some ceremonies, some rituals require very extravagant body movements, and the robe allows you to do that.
And there's different color robes that are used for different ceremonies. Different colors are attributed to different planets. If you want to do, like I was saying before, like a ritual involving Mars, most likely oftentimes will wear a red robe. Venus, I believe you might be wearing something like purple. or maybe even red because of the love aspect. But yeah, which goes into the gestures CJ was talking about. Gestures are very symbolic and ritual work, and the gestures are another tool. And depending on what type of magic you're trying to do or ritual you're using, you might assume a position of a god form, which, you know, links you and resonates you with that divinity. It brings you closer to it, and it elevates your consciousness spiritually so as to attain a certain state of mind. While you're performing your work, or even your own, and even like their astral, you might imagine a god form and become that god form. So it's all part of the aids in the mission at hand. Let's see what else we got involving that one. And there's different motions and certain rituals, like even like the LBRP. You thrust forward into the pentagrams and you pull back, and you might make the sign of the enterer. Sign of the enterer, in which you thrust forward into the pentagram while you vibrate the name. And once you're done, you might call back and do the sign of silence, in which you bring your left finger up to your lips and you stomp a little bit. You stomp on the floor a little bit with your left foot. I mean, like, these things might sound a little funny or weird or kind of out of the ordinary, but they do have a psychological effect when you're actually performing them and you're actually in it. So, trying to think of what else we have in terms of tools.
The tarot.
Yeah, it's another excellent tool.
Yeah, the tarot is a huge tool. Even in Right Hand Path, Golden Dawn stuff, they love the tarot.
Oh, yeah. Huge fan.
and honestly, the tarot is a wonderful thing, even for the beginner magician, to utilize. The tarot has a long history. It was originally crafted in the 15th century out in Europe, and it was originally played as a game called tarot.
I think that's also where the actual card games we have today, like casino cards, a regular standard deck, aces, spades, mm-hmm. jacks, kings, that entire structure of those cards that we all love, see everywhere, that formality, the gambling, all that stuff, those cards literally come from the tarot mm-hmm. cards. The tarot cards were like the original the original pack of cards that
I have. I've played the original game for it too. It's very similar to bridge.
With the tarot?
Yeah, it's fun. I haven't played in a long time because I don't have anybody in my life anymore that knows how to play.
Yeah.
But it was good. The tarot is a deck of 78 cards. You have 22 major arcana and 56 minor arcana. There are four suits within a tarot deck. A modern tarot deck uses wands, pentacles, swords, and cups,
Yep.
Which relates back to the altar, elemental tools.
Yep.
Yeah, but that's not the original symbols that they had. The original symbols were batons, coins, swords, and cups.
Interesting.
Yeah, batons later became wands, and coins later became pentacles.
Yeah, probably pentacles. Yeah. I'm a fan of the transition there.
So there was this guy named Antoine Coeur de Gebelin.
Yeah, I've heard of him before.
Yeah, yeah. He once tried to associate the suits of the tarot with the Book of Thoth.
Book of Thoth, yeah.
Thoth, is that how you say that guy's name?
It's commonly pronounced as Thoth or Thoth, but, you know, just whatever works.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, he was an extremely prominent Egyptian god of wisdom and magic and of writing.
It was later actually debunked, that theory. Because when he came out with that theory, people had just started utilizing the tarot for divination practices. It was a very new concept, which brings us to the next guy here, Jean-Baptiste Alliet. He wrote the very first book of divinations called Attila, which is just his name spelled backwards, L'Art de lire dans cartes, which it's French. It translates to the art of the cards.
Yeah, so sorry about any mispronunciation. We're English here.
Yeah, it's actually, I actually speak French, but I'm reading my own handwriting. That's the problem.
Yeah. That could always be a problem.
Yeah. And later, another guy named Eliphas Levy believed that he could associate magic as a scientific basis for divinity, linking the tarot to the Kabbalah.
Yeah, which you easily can. The Kabbalah, which is something I'm really excited to speak about in a episode coming up, most likely soon, because it's an extremely important topic in magic. You can place all the tarot cards on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, as with so many other things, which we'll talk about later. It's another topic. Eliphas Levi. He was a French magician, very prominent French Christian magician. He wrote a lot of books. His two most important books are The Key of the Mysteries, which Aleister Crowley edited because he believed that he was a reincarnation of Eliphas Levi. And his other most important work is Transcendental Magic. It's Theory and Practice, I believe, just in case people are interested in that. I've read both of them. I have both of them. They're extremely good, great books, especially Transcendental Magic. The Key of the Mysteries is kind of a little bit more advanced, but nonetheless, they're both extremely important works. But getting back to what we were speaking about, we went over so far the vibration of names, how important sounds are and vibrations are in ceremony. We went over the pentagram, its prominence, its use in certain rituals. We went over the elemental tools, being the sword, the cup, the wand, and the pentacle. We've spoken about black mirrors, crystal balls, gestures. Stones, gems, and crystals, just to give like an overview of all the things that can be used within a ceremony and how they can all come together. We spoke about the circle, the lamp, the robe. And at the end of everything, the most important tool that you can have in any type of magic or ritual work or even any endeavor in life at that is the mind. We had said before that these tools aren't necessary once you reach a certain point, although regardless, they'll always aid the magician in his task. But the mind overall is the most important tool one can have. As the two most important tools to have in magic, once trained, is the imagination and the will. So at the end of the day, like if you don't have a properly trained mind and your elements aren't balanced within, you don't have a good focus, and you can't do like you can't focus your mind on something for a while, which is why meditation is such an important tool along these paths, your rituals are most likely going to be ineffective. You have to incorporate your entire being, your entire vessel, which incorporates your body, the movements of your body, the sound of your voice, scents, using your olfactory senses. You have to use your sight through sigils, through colors, And you have, most importantly, you have to use your mind through your will, through really, really wanting to achieve something and being able to focus on that intently and passionately, and being able to use your imagination to invoke and create the changes and to envision things and to transcend the normal, ordinary consciousness that we have in everyday life. So, yeah, that's those are the primary tools, mind being the most important above all.
But the mind in itself is so important that even the most basic of tools will not function properly for you unless you are complete. Like, even if you're just working with, you know, a pendulum work, you have to focus your mind on that. It'll just stand there. It won't do anything, you know, without the mind being there. And if you're trying to do something with like a spirit board, or a Ouija board, you're trying to use a planchette or the pendulum in itself. Like you said, the mind is super important when it comes to those things. You know, without focusing, you get nothing.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, different traditions use variations of these tools that we had just mentioned. I'm just more of a ceremonial magic theurgy type of guy. But, you know, when it comes to certain spiritual traditions today, Wicca is a pretty primary one that we see that's pretty popular, which Gerald Gardner helped create, who was a student of Aleister Crowley, or at least an accomplice of him. And in Wicca, we see a lot of the same type of tools that I had just spoken about, like the athame on the altar, like Wiccans, who they have altars as well. They just have a different, set of beliefs. I think they believe in like the triple goddess and a horn god, or like the aspects of the goddess and a male and female god, and it's ultimate.
I know
something like that.
There's the goddess who resides within the moon, and then the god who is the sun, or the father, I've heard it referred to as. And then the main thing that I know about Wicca in comparison to, say, witchcraft, is that Wicca supports the system of karma.
Okay.
That's like the big difference that I know.
Okay.
I dabbled in Wicca when I was about 15 or 16.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, and I held on to the karma system myself.
I do as well.
Yeah. But as far as it goes, when it comes to other things with that, a lot of their practices support. You're big on ceremonial magic. I like divination.
Mm-hmm.
That's my thing. I like the tarot. I like the pendulum. I don't really mess with spirit boards. I know that the Ouija board wasn't really demonized until 1973, where the church decided that the planchette was a portal and spirits are allowed through. I don't physically myself have a reason to believe that. But I also don't have a reason to not believe it, and it's enough that I won't play with those myself.
Yeah, I don't advise. I think we spoke about this in a previous episode. I don't advise anybody to use any type of Ouija board whatsoever. You don't know what you're going to draw on. There's no protection. You're not trained. You know, you're inviting anybody in. Like, you don't know what you're doing with that. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's just an unorthodox way to deal with this type of stuff.
At least while you're a beginner. I mean, if you really have somebody in your life who really knows what they're doing and you're comfortable with that situation and you're comfortable with there could be consequences that you have no control over, you know, by all means. But us personally, not a thing we like to mess with.
Not at all.
But yeah, the Ouija board itself was demonized in 1973 after the release of the movie The Exorcist. And then the church was like, oh, that's what that does? Because Hollywood's always correct. but there was that. Another thing that's utilized within Wicca, I don't know what they call them in Wicca, but I know in the Christian church they call them censers.
Yep. Yeah, that's something I should have brought up earlier with ceremonial work too. But yes, they have censers as well.
Yeah, the censers, oftentimes there's something like frankincense burning inside, which will allow, or other incense in itself, which will allow smoke to come out. And the idea is that the smoke will carry your prayers or your energies into the cosmos to those divine beings.
Yeah, and it can also aid the mind and it's psychological, you know, aid. Like, you know, like the sense influence the mind or bring about certain atmospheric feelings to the mind while doing a certain work. Like I personally like to burn any type of sage or Palo Santo in my sensor that I personally have. I do that a lot for, you know, just to clear the room of negative energy or whether, you know, psychological energy or just to cleanse the area. They're two really important tools, I guess, on top of it. But yeah, once again, sage is a really common tool in terms of an herb that's used during ritual work or to cleanse the area, banishing spirits, banishing negative energy. It's pretty common, probably one of the most common things that you might hear about in this area.
The other tool that I know of that gets used a lot within Wicca and then other practices is the candle. I'm part of a Facebook group, which is absolutely fantastic. Super positive. The admins are great and everything. If you guys at all are interested in joining, a group, where you would practice witchcraft in itself, it's called Witchcraft for Beginners. It's a great group. It really is. I haven't experienced a negative individual, at least not one that wasn't very swiftly dealt with. And very welcoming, and they really have fantastic resources with all the stuff that we're discussing on this episode. And it's also a great place to find our episode, you know, if you want to.
You know, just in case.
On Sundays when I'm allowed to post it. But a lot of the people in that group utilize jar spells. And part of the jar spells is where they melt down a candle. It's fascinating. I never heard of a jar spell until joining this group. And they use the candle to seal it. Candles will also seal things called Dybbuk boxes, which is something you should never play with. We don't ever mess with Dybbuk boxes. I know there's people on YouTube that buy them and open them, and you can buy them for $100. Don't do that.
They definitely sound weird. I don't really know much about them.
You never seen a Dybbuk box? So a Dybbuk box.
You might have shown one to me before, but yeah, they seem kind of sketchy.
Yeah, the Dybbuk box is a box, and within it typically contains a crystal or a stone, and then like some other things, like maybe like a flower or a series of petals or some herbs. A spirit is contained within the box, and then a candle is melted over it to seal the box. And if you open it, you release the spirit. Typically, it's not a nice one that gets put in the box.
Mm.
It's very left-hand path.
I see. Yeah, that only sounds kind of weird.
It's something you would create to give to another person to make their life miserable.
Okay.
So, I mean, maybe down the line we'll talk about that more. No, we will never ever do a product review for that.
No, I guess we're not going to get one then.
No! I won't even let that in my house.
Yeah. Just buy one and put it in another box. It's like, nah, man.
No, I don't even at all. I don't even want to be anywhere near one of those. Like, yeah. Angry spirits are not something I have any ambition to be anywhere near.
I mean, we deal with enough angry people out here, right?
Right.
Let alone a freaking angry something we can't see.
Sometimes I'm one of those angry people.
Yeah,
you know.
we all succumb to the, you know, the anger side sometimes.
Yeah, but the candle in itself has several uses. It can be burned in the name of an individual. Depending on the, we've been saying this so much this episode, depending on the path you're on.
Yeah, sorry about that, but, you know, that has to be reiterated.
It is super important because not everybody believes the same thing.
Yeah, these aren't like set in stone names and purposes, but they're common. Yeah. They're common.
We're not here to push any one set of beliefs on an individual. This is really, we just want to provide the best education we can when it comes to all these different things. But the candle in itself, you can focus on it to focus your energies. You can burn it in the name of an individual if you're trying to help them or harm them. I know certain belief paths, you don't cast a spell on an individual without their permission, even if it is something good. You could put a good spell on an individual and invoke bad karma on yourself because you didn't have that person's permission.
Yeah, this thing is like infringing on someone else's will. Will being really important in life is definitely a serious act of black magic.
Yeah, yeah. The candles, the melted wax is very often used to seal. It's a very large significance is sealing with melted wax. I know people will read the flame. For divination purposes, they'll also read how the wax melts. The smoke from the candle, if it goes straight up, I know that the energy in the area is clear. If it goes away from you, I'm not going to speculate because I don't remember and I don't want to give you bad information. But it's funny, but I don't want to say something, have you regurgitate that later and have somebody who knows what they're doing look at you and be like, I'm sorry,
who told you that? Nah, this one podcast, dude.
Let's leave a bad review.
Yeah, don't listen to that podcast, dude.
Yeah. So I'm not going to ever tell you. If I don't know, I'm not going to say. But if it comes towards you, if it moves away from you, they'll read the smoke for that. The candle's a very powerful tool.
Yeah, that's one I should have mentioned before, too. I didn't really think to bring it up. It's just so mundane and common. But yeah, candles are always typically always burn in a ritual ceremony or any type of act of magic. And theurgy, you know, it's there to psychologically aid the mind and, you know, your connection to the divine. It's kind of like symbolic of the fire of God or, you know, God's essence, you know, the flame we have being one of the closest symbolological references to that and a way we can connect to that, like the light and the dark and all those things. And then also the color, the candle, bringing it back to the colors is also important. Colors, you know, whether it be like on like a tool or the candle, extremely important too.
And what the candle's encased in. I know a lot in a practice called Brujeria, Mother Mary will be on a glass jar that the candle is either formed in or placed in. Candle use is used on everything. It's a place on the left, the right, or the center of the pentagram. You'll have cameras. Oh my Lord. You'll have candles used within churches a lot, especially in Catholicism. You go there and you light a candle for an individual, especially someone who has passed or someone you're praying for.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'll see it in Judaism, especially like the menorah. You'll see it in Arabic, Islamic tradition, Buddhist tradition. Candles are everywhere. Every major religion, every pagan religion, every practice for magic, ceremony, ritual. You're going to see candles at some point.
Yeah, and they also have the candelabra, which is like multiple candles in one. Things of that sort. I guess the comeback real quick with the Wicca, since it's prominent, some of the same tools are like the athame, like we mentioned earlier. You might have like symbols carved into it, magical symbols, planetary symbols, spirit symbols. Another one is the bell, and the bell can be stricken too. Pretty much represents like the beginning of a ceremony or the closing of a ceremony. There's this thing called the bowline. It's like this cutting type of tool. It's used for cutting objects, cutting herbs, inscribing things. A cauldron is something that's kind of stereotypical. You might see in movies around the magical sort or witchcraft and stuff, but you know, cauldrons are used. It can be used for scrying, as we'd seen before, burning ingredients, fires, things of that sort. The chalice for libations, like we had talked about, and the pentacle as well is used in the Wicca. Usually the centerpiece of the altar, and it represents the earth element, and it can be made from various metals. And like we see, there's so many parallels across a lot of these traditions. So
they also have besoms, which is brooms. Another stereotypical.
Another stereotypical one.
And then what is this word? Stangs.
You got a stang, dude?
Stangs.
Okay. What does a stang do?
It's a staff. This okay. This picture has a. Yeah, I'm pulling up a book while we're recording. it's a horned staff specifically. It's a staff topped with some form of antler.
Interesting. I've never heard of that one before.
Supposedly, it's used for traveling to help the journeying spirit.
Okay.
I never heard of that one either myself. But yeah.
I don't know if that's a common one or what. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic book. If anybody's wondering where I pulled that from, it's a book called The History of Magic, Witchcraft, and the Occult. I'm very, very big on, you can know all the method you want, history is just as important, because if you don't know where it's been, you don't know where it's going.
Yeah, you don't, or unless you might lose touch of the original intent. Mm-hmm. I haven't purposely read the book myself, but just upon seeing it, it's beautifully illustrated, a lot of pictures, a lot of colors, beautiful design. I'm gonna have to check it out at some point.
Oh, I'm almost done with it, and you can totally borrow it.
But yeah, it looks like a nice book. And something that also spans a lot of practices. I have myself, Wiccans have, you know, other people of practice. Wiccans might call it a book of shadows. A ceremonial magician might just be called the book. But it's essentially a book that in which the magician or a witch or whatever just writes down all the rituals that they. Or writes down certain rituals that they might accumulate along their path, rituals that they might want to use in the future. It's a book that can be held during a ceremony or a ritual to read off of, because a lot of these, you know, invocations, evocations deal with a lot of written words, paragraphs, sentences, names of power, spirit names, and it's kind of like possible to remember all that stuff. So unless you've been doing it forever. But yeah, so oftentimes a magician will hold this book in their hand, make gestures with the right hand, possibly use implements or tools with the right hand or any hand at that point, and hold in the other hand the book and read off of it, incantations or whatever they're doing. Also, the Book of Shadows or the Book of the Magician, they write down their experiences, anything they might experience during like a ritual, anything they might experience during their daily life, things they're noticing about themselves, changes, things about the universe, just any type of transcendental experience that they're having. They'll jot all that stuff down in the book so that, you know, they have a reference point of their ascendancy and of their experiences, and just something to look back on to show, you know, their growth.
I actually just made my first Book of Shadows.
Okay.
Not long ago, which sounds really bad because I'm on a podcast and I'm sort of supposed to be an expert, I guess, and I'm not at all.
I just call myself a student.
I really am. Like, by all meanings of the word, a student, I'm experiencing, by doing this, I'm experiencing things that I've never done before. Like I said, I primarily mess with divination. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically speaking, I've been working with divination for like 15 years, where I do like the tarot, the pendulum, reading candle flames and wax. A lot of experience, but like the concept of something like the Book of Shadows, I knew of it.
Yeah.
But I never made one myself. I didn't see a need because I really wasn't going beyond the things that I knew. But yeah, I just made my first one, and it looks like a fourth grade art project. I dug into my son's arts and crafts supplies, like construction paper, and there's like little cottons and popsicle sticks and stuff. And really, I had a reason for that. Like, I had better materials to utilize. I wanted that because I wanted the book to be imbued with a pure energy, and it doesn't get much more pure than innocence. And the innocence of a child playing with their craft supplies, that's a wonderful energy to have in something.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
Yeah, so I really, my specific book, I haven't written it yet, but I'm actually putting a book curse on it. So that anyone of ill intent, if they were to open it, would experience horrible things to them. Because I really don't want that book to ever fall into the hands of somebody who would use it for darker purposes. Not necessarily, like, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you're like, oh, CJ, oh, what's wrong with dark magic? Nothing. Nothing. But I personally don't practice, and I don't want anyone to use my objects for the practice. So, I mean, if you practice, by all means, go for it, but not me.
Yeah, I have my own opinions on dark and black magic and baneful magic. I'm not for it. I don't think it's good to harm people. I think it's good to protect yourself. That's the one thing. But, you know, if that's what you do, that's what you do, as long as you feel right doing it in your heart and soul. And hopefully it's all for the greater good. But no disrespect to anybody who does.
We definitely want to keep you as a listener.
Yeah, it's all for, you know, there's something we can learn from everybody. You know, there's reasons why everybody does what they do. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not saying they're wrong. We all have our own perspectives, our own upbringings, our own, you know, ways of dealing with things. So, you know, at the end of the day, who knows? Who knows what's right? And who knows what's wrong?
We will definitely have episodes where we cover left-hand path, dark things, because at the end of the day, this is for education. So it wouldn't be fair to not include that.
Yeah, we'd be including everything.
Transparency, when it comes to things like this, transparency is key. And if you hold on to secrets, people can get hurt.
Yeah.
So our goal is to provide you with as much information as possible so that you bare minimum have a space to begin your path and have an idea of what you want to seek.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that pretty much wraps up everything I have to say on the topic. I don't know if there's anything else you have extra offhand. Let's see.
No. This is a week's worth of notes, and I think we covered everything. Oh, I mean, we have crystals and gems we sort of touched on.
Yeah, we touched upon that a little bit. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are into that. I have, like, a history here for it, but... honestly, the main point with crystals and gems is something you can read in Buckland's book, which is like a comprehensive book of witchcraft. And the idea is that the color of the gem vibrates, we're back to vibrations, colored wavelengths. And utilizing specific gems for the wavelengths they put out balances energies. And that's the idea behind that. And you can also use things like clear quartz, similar ways that you would use like a crystal ball.
Yeah, essentially. And we also touched upon that earlier, like the colors and their effects, like you said, the resonance, the vibrations. But yeah, overall, the most common implements and tools, just as another recapitulation, black mirror, crystal ball, you have the wand, you have the sword, the pentacle, the cup, the altar, the circle, the suffumigations, you know, like the oils or things that you burn for scent, colors, if I didn't mention that, sound. You might even play music during a ceremony as a tool to tune your mind to a certain mindset, vibrations that you use, your own voice, your senses, and ultimately your mind. And I guess that the book, you know, the journal, and they have your rituals and your experiences in it. That's a little comprehensive look.
That about wraps it up. Have we decided what we're going to cover next time?
Well, next week we have an episode in which we're interviewing an author.
Yes.
We're going to be interviewing Leandra Witchwood. So next week,
We really get into some practice with that. The subject will be kitchen magic, green witchery, tea magic, things like that.
Yeah, so maybe that's something to look forward to. I'm definitely excited about it. See what's in store for that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. And maybe if we're lucky, we'll even get a couple of little instructionals so you guys can actually listen to our episode and then go do something with it too.
Yeah, and it seems like she's definitely more from like a witchcraft background, which I
100%.
Yeah, and which I'm not. So it's definitely, I'm looking forward to it to learn more about witchcraft in general. I was drawn personally to witchcraft heavily when I was in high school, even when I was younger, maybe like 13. Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to get some more information on that. Just so you guys know, if I'm talking about like theurgy and like astrotheurgy and ceremonial magic, that's my background, or the Golden Dawn. I'm a big Golden Dawn type of person. That's where I might be getting a lot of my primary focus from. I know there's like a lot of other tools using voodoo and, you know, witchcraft and all these other, so many different traditions. So if I'm not covering those, that's a big reason why. But I'm also covering a lot of tools I've personally used myself. So if we're missing a lot of them out,
CJ's just got your back.
It's a rough trying to organize all this stuff into one thing.
But you're the theater guy, and I'm definitely the witchcraft background guy.
Yeah.
And we make our own little yin-yang.
Yeah, that's why we're trying to like balance this out, trying to construct a fluent podcast for you guys to listen to. And it's definitely interesting and fun along the way. But yeah, if there's anything that you guys want to inform us on, even any corrections, if we got something wrong, any questions you have along your path, your journey, or just any questions you have in general, maybe even about life, or just anything. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Instagram at mystery.stone.podcast. We also have a Gmail. You can contact us at mystery.stone.podcast@gmail.com.
We also have a Facebook group, which people have been joining here and there over the last couple of days, which is starting to build up a little bit, which is nice.
I really appreciate that. Thank you guys, by the way.
Yeah, it's awesome. We love interacting with you. And I try to put a little something in there. I try once a day. Sometimes it's every other day, something like that. I do put a couple of humorous things in there. So, you know, we don't joke too much on the show because we're really focused on providing that education. But within the podcast group, we really post up some more humorous things. Serious stuff still too. Definitely serious stuff. So that's another thing that we have to offer for you guys.
Yeah, so, and to all you guys viewing or who are consistently viewing or even gave us a little bit of time once more, I from the bottom of my heart, I really, really appreciate it. I have no expectations for this. I just love to, I'm very passionate about these topics and I just want to express them and, you know, maybe share information and learn stuff in the process. So, yeah, I'm extremely grateful for all your guys' time, clicks, views, even thoughts. And yeah, so that's about that. Thank you guys so much. And hopefully I'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, same. Blessed be.